You're listening to a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast. 20 minutes with Andrew May. Hello, literary alchemists. I'm Dave Robison.
And I'm Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast, 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is a segment in which Dave and I have the great pleasure to share the microphone with some really cool people. And today is somebody who I haven't been able to find something that he hasn't done.
So I know. It goes way beyond artistic Swiss Army knife. This gentleman is remarkable. He is, of course, an author of spec fic and thriller novels. His recent work, Hollywood Pharaohs, was ranked the number 3 best-rated mystery on Amazon.com. He's also written Killer Angel, an urban fantasy crime thriller, the Chronological Man series, which, friends, I'm just about through the first one, and it's freaking amazing. It's like steampunk meets Doctor Who. It's awesome. That first book is Monster in the Mist, followed up very quickly by The Martian Emperor, and I'm sure there will be more to come. Plus, Grendel's Shadow and Public Enemy Zero are all available in ebook and audio formats. Now, his weekly podcast, Andrew Main Stories, includes readings of his short fiction and chapters from his novels, which is just fabulous. But wait, there's more. There's also Weird Things, which is both a website and a weekly podcast, delivering the latest bizarre news from the world of science, and is produced along with Justin Robert Young, Matt Finley, and Bill Meeks. But wait, there's more. He's also a partner in Jerris Main Productions, which recently produced G4 Underground for the G4 Network. Now, if you're listening to all this going, this can't possibly be true. This is like magic. Well, you're right, because our guest host is a magician. And that's not true. He's not just a magician. He's a magician's magician. The man has consulted for Penn and Teller, David Blaine, and many others. He's published over 50 books and DVDs on magic and publishes the itricks.com website, bringing you the latest news and information from the world of magic. Seriously, friends, I'm not bullshitting you on this. This guy's got it all going on. So, friends, welcome to the big chair at the Roundtable Podcast, our guest host for this episode of 20 Minutes with Mr. Andrew Main. Andrew, holy crap, I don't know how you find the time to come and join us on the podcast, but thank you so much for doing it.
Well, I have no social life, gentlemen, so it's absolutely a pleasure to be here because I wasn't going to do anything else.
Yeah, I'm betting that ain't exactly the case. Now, my first question for you, Andrew, is are we talking to you or one of your many clones?
It's me. And many of the things you described there, I am very fortunate to work with other people who are very, very talented and capable and actually kind of right on their shoulders. So, you know, that's one of the big things I can tell you. It's just find people smarter than you, more hardworking than you, and partner with them and then let them do the work.
Dude, you just described any success that we have with this podcast because we're always doing that, like yourself.
Yes.
Now, I'm going to make a note. We've got 20 minutes, so I'm going to take my 20 minutes note here and start the timer. And my first question, very quick question, in reading your bio and exploring the many works that you did, it wasn't really clear to me where in all of that awesomeness did you actually start writing? Was it after you left the stage magician career path and started exploring other things? When did you start writing?
I've been writing nonfiction for, going back 15 years or so professionally in some capacity. And that started with writing magic books and how-to manuals explaining how to perform magic effects, original ideas, and did that for a number of years. And then I also wrote for like skeptic magazines and some science advocacy stuff and would do articles in that area. And the fiction sort of jaunt, that didn't happen until just a little over a year ago until I finally decided just to get into that.
Now, here's my question for you then. With all of the amazing and I assume fairly time-consuming creative venues at your disposal that you're pursuing, why do you write? What is it that writing lets you accomplish that all your other projects and ventures don't?
You know, you find that when you want to be creative, whatever field you go into, there are going to be limitations. And they're either going to be the ones that are self-inflicted or they're going to be just the way the world works. If you want to be a filmmaker, film is a very collaborative thing. And you've got to find actors, you've got to get equipment, you've got to get financing, you've got to do a lot of things to make a film happen. If you want to write a screenplay, you can just sit there and write them all you want. They may never see the light of day, but that's a lot easier.
Right.
And I've done a lot of different things. And for me, Magic was cool because, you know, you could kind of produce your own show, but then you were still counting on producers to put you in somewhere. You're counting on just the markets and the taste of the audience. And as I got older and found that sometimes I was feeling a little bit, I don't want to say creatively frustrated, but I wasn't having as many outlets as I would like, I started to gravitate towards things. On one hand, I partner with people who are very capable and much more skilled at certain things I didn't have. For instance, television. My partner, Mary Jarris, she's a skilled television producer and can help make those things happen a lot easier than I would ever be able to. And it comes to blogging, working with Justin Robert Young, who's a fantastic blogger and can do the daily grind. That worked there. But for just kind of my own sort of personal kind of endeavors, I was very attracted to the idea that with writing, and particularly now in this era we're in with ebooks, that you can sit down, write something, and you can find an audience. You never have to mail a manuscript to New York City and wait for a response a year later. You don't have somebody telling you what you can or cannot write. The only thing that matters is if people like it or not. If they don't, then you write for yourself. But if they do, then you write to them.
Okay. And your works are predominantly genre works. You're working in spec fic, urban fantasy, steampunk, thrillers. Why the genre fiction? What was it that drew you in that direction?
Well, I don't know if it's all genre fiction. For instance, Angel Killer is pretty much a thriller, and Hollywood Pharaohs is a mystery. And I certainly was initially was attracted to genre fiction, and I plan to do some more of that. I've always loved science fiction as a kid. I was a big Heinlein fan, a big Isaac Asimov fan, and that certainly warped me at an early age. And when I would think about – I think we can all relate to that. We have those authors that shaped us. And that certainly put me into that track, but – The first was just a novella, was The Grendel Shadow, which was very much was this post-singularity steampunk kind of story. And as soon as I wrote that, I said, you know, I want to do something that's more contemporary, a little bit of a sci-fi element, but really more of a thriller. And that was Public Enemy Zero. And that was just to make sure that I didn't get too caught up in writing in one kind of genre as opposed to another.
Right. There's a substantial amount of setup, tease, and then ultimate reveal in thriller and spec fic and sci-fi and a lot of genre fiction in general in terms of just sort of pattern. Would you say that the transition from magic to writing fiction was kind of a natural one that you used to inform your fiction?
I think, you know, good magic is good storytelling, and it's understanding conflicts and resolution and setbacks. And the better areas of magic I was able to contribute to certainly reflected that. And so when it came to sitting down to writing, you know, a genre story is kind of like having, you know, one big magical conceit or one big mystery or one science conceit that makes something possible versus, you know, a thriller. You know, I tend to have that. What is that mystery? How does it work? And then the reveal of that, and to try to make that as entertaining as possible.
Right. Yeah. And there seems to be a lot of research that has gone into your writing as well. Is that something that you've developed over time with the other things that you've done that you can borrow from and kind of throw in here and there to your storylines?
Yeah, certainly I'm going to write towards things that I'm familiar with, and that helps because I've had people like, man, you did so much research on this thing. I'm like, well, I'm not writing a book about brain surgery because I don't know anything about that. But if I have a weird interest, I'll write about it. And there's some things I don't know. Like I have, you know, for a future project, I have a whole manual on the weapons and equipment of the Chinese Navy because I wanted to be able to talk reasonably intelligently about that. And so it's always, I choose things that I want to know more about. I've got another sci-fi thing and I've been doing a lot of stuff on orbital mechanics, near-Earth asteroids and everything else like that because I think there's a lot of interesting ideas there and interesting science that's much more near-term. So, you know, I'm trying to brush up on that and finding that my math skills are not what I'd like them to be.
Definitely.
Yeah, I was told there would be no math myself, and I was lied to, damn it. Andrew, let me ask. Stephen King is quoted as saying, you write the first draft with the door closed, and the second draft with the door open. which I interpret as you write your story, the story you want to tell, and then when you're polishing and revising, you start considering the reader. And this might seem like a really weird question, but I believe that all of us, when we start that process of refining our work towards someone, that we have someone in mind. We may not, may not give them a name or anything, but they're, when you're polishing and thinking about your audience or the person or people that you're writing for, that there's an actual tangible or conceptual thing in mind as you're doing that. And my question is, do you find that to be true for yourself? And if so, can you describe that person that you're writing to?
I certainly find that's true. And I will, if I may be so bold, I will add a one additional step to Mr. King's approach there. And that is that my first thing I do is I pitch the idea to my friends and the sort of the back of the book cover description, sort of the little synopsis of what's going to happen, because I want to get an idea. Is this something that interests me and only me, or is it something that other people would go, oh, that's cool. And that's probably because I try to write a little more commercially than just pure literary. So okay. I want to know that if I give somebody a small description, that'll be an interest there. Right. And then once I have that, once I know, like, okay, other people think this would be an interesting idea or conflict, then I absolutely do that. I sit down, I write the thing. Occasionally, at the very beginning, I might give a couple chapters to a friend to take a look at, just so I can make sure that I got the right tone. And I've thrown out entire first parts of books because of that, because I said, this is coming off nowhere near the way that I pitched it to them, and it was a different way than I thought. So once I finally sit down to do the writing, I have in mind somebody like myself, somebody who maybe reads a lot of stuff, is a little bit scientifically literate, and will pay attention to the details because they often find that interesting. And once I'm done, the first person I hand my book to is my buddy Justin Robert Young, who you mentioned earlier, who's the co-host of the Weird Things podcast. Right. And he's got a very good eye for stuff. He's very good at looking for where maybe the story I jumped across too much, or things that may not be as clear as they could have been. And, he has full permission to give me whatever criticisms he wants and knows that I encourage that. And I seek really the critique and not the praise. And right. So there's the ideal version of who I write for, and then the first person who sees it would be Justin, because he's for me, has been a very good collaborator at that phase.
Now, have you ever actually had a pitch that you've given to your friends where they've said, isn't very good?
People are polite, and they won't necessarily say that. And right. I'll tell you, that's one of the things I've learned from magic. In magic, we've got a lot of people at various different skill levels. Various different. That's you can use that, by the way.
Good. Thank you.
Various different. I like that.
And what'll happen is you'll learn a magic trick. You go perform for a friend, and it's like writing a short story. And then you show it to them, and they'll go, oh, that's great. That's really good. And what they mean is by the standards at which we judge what you produce, not mm-hmm. by how we judge the rest of the world. And sometimes our friends and family can't tell the difference. And you've got to become very attuned to understanding faint praise from real praise, and understand when somebody really likes something or not, and not just go, well, everybody likes it. And that's where people often get very, very defensive. For me, it's about the work. So I kind of try to embrace the critique, and I understand I'm never going to reach perfection, but I think that's a very, very valuable point. So when I go pitch these ideas, I'll certainly get this, oh, okay. It's interesting or whatever. And then I'll just say, okay, what don't you understand about it to appreciate its brilliance? Yeah. What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Damn it, this is a master work. What are you thinking? Yes.
Right. I am fully prepared. Everything I do, I've got stuff sitting in drawers. I've got entire books that I finished that have sat there, and I go, there's just something, I've rewritten things entirely. I've got stuff that I go do, and I said, it's not where I wanted to go, and I've thrown it out, and novels. And I'm not in a hurry to go take that to everything that I produce and show it to people and go, hey, look at this. And it's easier if you can sort of figure that out at an earlier phase and make sure that you have all the steps of the story you need. Sometimes I don't wait. That's a mistake.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Andrew Main after this promotional break.
I am Athel, Seraph of the First Choir. I was the first Aeonian across that barrier that separates mortality from eternity, and the individual from the indivisible. I was the first angel amongst men. Mankind was simpler then, and your squabbles were petty. But in them I saw the seeds of the war, so I came amongst you and taught of the conflict. A lowlands tribe, eager to prepare for the coming of the great enemy, gathered in their neighbors, uniting them into a nation. But those who would not consent to be gathered were conquered. I had given you the war, but the enemy had not yet come. And so you reached out to find one. I shall carry this regret for all eternity. Before ever you knew what a demon was, an angel taught you to hate.
Twixt Heaven and Hell by Tristan Gregory. Available now at Amazon and Smashwords.
Now let's get back to the conversation with Andrew Main. Do you have completed works that are just kind of sitting around at this point?
Yeah.
So what is it that prompts you to take a story like Monster in the Mist or Public Enemy Zero and put that out there? And what is it about those books that are sitting on the shelf or in the drawer right now that are holding you back from putting them out there?
Sometimes you get to the end of a story and you go, did I tell the story I wanted to tell? And I'm all about premises. I love a really good premise, and I hate to waste a premise when I could have perhaps told the story a little bit better. And sometimes I get to the end of it and I go, you know what? I did the outline. I followed to the detail, but I think that I made some critical mistakes here that I could have had the characters function differently. And I think at that point, to try to go back and copy paste is not worth it. You're just better to start off over again. Okay. But you know, and it's hard to know when you're right on that or when it's not. You know, the first novel length thing I put out was Public Enemy Zero just a little over a year ago. And I got to the end of that. I gave that to my buddy Justin. I'm like, listen, if you don't think we should put this out there, you know, I'll sit on it. It's totally cool. It's your call. Just, you know, tell me what you think. And, you know, it became one of the top-selling thrillers on Amazon. The film rights got purchased by one of the biggest film production companies there is. And,
that's,
you know,
awesome.
It was a story that I was like, I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
Apparently you're not a good judge of what's awesome in the world these days. None of us are.
No. Oh, absolutely not. I mean, and that I really do believe that. And I tell other people to be mindful of when something's very popular and you criticize people for liking it, you may not understand why. You know, you take the Twilight books, okay? You know, as far as what we understand about story structure, writing, etc., you know, these books probably don't meet our ideals. But for a target demographic of 15-year-old girls or girls who, you know, people who kind of have this romantic idea about relationships and mysticism and whatever, it's perfect for them. The writing level is at the level at which those girls are thinking about the world. And they're not, you know, paying attention to the number of adverbs and adjectives in there and how flat the characters are. You know, they read these books in a much different way. In some ways, it's like sitting down for us to watch some people playing Magic the Gathering and going, this has no structure to it.
Hey, now.
There's no story here. Andrew, there are writers out there who vehemently and emphatically are against writers' groups in general, or and others that fall very squarely into the camp of, no, it's an awesome way. And it sounds like you're kind of working in between, that you're welcoming outside input about your stories, but still maintaining your creative spark at the core of what the story you're trying to tell. Do you have any advice for people who are just getting into the writing thing about how to handle presenting your work before it's done to a group of friends, colleagues, writing groups, or whatever, that will help them to get the most out of those experiences?
You got to understand who you're turning it over to. And the problem, like, I've been in one informal writer's group, really. It was when I lived in Japan, I had a magic show there, and every other night I used to write a short story and then go over to the the room where all the dancers slept, and I used to go read them a short story before they went to sleep. You know, these are girls getting out of their sequins and their G-strings and all that. And that was a very encouraging audience in which to write for. And then I was in I took a writer's workshop at a community college near me because I knew coming from writing fiction, or excuse me, nonfiction and getting into fiction, I'm a very linear, analytical kind of thinker. And I wanted to be around people who I thought, you know, would be probably more poetic and would look at things differently because I wanted that criticism. I wanted somebody who thought very differently from me to come in and take a look at that writing. And that's always been very helpful for me. You know, I've taken acting classes from, you know, teachers who are, you know, I'm very scientific, who are, you know, people who are very hippie, earth spirit kind of non-logical thinkers. And it was very helpful because they had a way of seeing things and there was a craft to what they did. The danger in writers groups is you're putting yourself in a room with a bunch of other people that want to do what you want to do. They want to be writers like you. And you're going to get response from other writers and not a response from consumers. Now, they may read a lot of books, but are they reading in the genre that you're writing to? You know, are they good critics of that genre and understand the tropes and what makes it work and why the top books are the top books and what aren't? So I think that need to be mindful of that. And so if you go into a writer's group and, you know, they're going to be looking at it from one way when your goal is that person who's never been at a writer's group, who's never written more than 2,000 words in a sitting, is going to be the person consuming your book.
That's excellent advice.
You know, writer's groups are great ways to try to figure out how to evolve to get the praise from other writers. In magic, there's a corollary. We have magic conventions, and you go to a magic convention, and you put on a show in front of a bunch of other magicians, and they decide who's the best magician. We have big, huge competitions, you know, that like every 2 years in the world, we decide who is the greatest magician there is. None of, you know, probably I would bet that almost nobody listening to this podcast could name a single person who ever won one of those competitions.
Because it wasn't David Copperfield and it wasn't Penn and Teller.
It wasn't Penn and Teller. It wasn't David Blaine. Right. Wasn't Chris Angel. And, you know, the only guy that ever did, you know, he became famous because back in the day, Johnny Carson took a liking to what he did and put him on the Carson show. So what magic conventions do is they create people who are very good at winning magic competitions.
Interesting.
And writers groups can do the same thing. But I do think there's an absolute value there, though. There is a certain, you know, going in front of strangers and having presenting your work, I do advise at some point, but you got to remember when it's no longer going to give you what you want.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's excellent.
Now, considering all of the crazy stuff that's on your plate, do you have a set routine that helps you churn stuff out? How do you approach writing?
I'm still trying to figure out, you know, my habits and trying to differentiate between what is a necessary routine or what is just something I've fallen into. And I don't know. I used to, when I first got started, I would sit down and I'd force myself to write, you know, 20,000 words a day if I could. Mm-hmm. And then I would sit back and say, okay, you know, if I do 20,000 words a day, is that going to be the most productive way to do it? Or should I dial it back and just write how much I think I need to at a time and understand that sometimes I don't want to write because I'm tired or bored with it, or I don't want to write because I haven't resolved something in my outline that should be resolved. And
right.
So, you know, I'm still figuring that out. But I do believe in having kind of a clear idea when something should be done.
Yeah. I'm kind of choking on my own breath here. 20,000
words a
day is a lot.
Are you aware of Nathan Lowell, Andrew? Have you heard that name? No. He is a podcast and author and so much more. He's a podcaster, author, and so many things. And in our circle of specfic podcasters, he's legendary. In fact, there's a unit of measure for word count. It is called the Lowell. and you have achieved Lowellian levels of productivity.
Oh, yes.
20,000 words a day.
Yeah. That's double the Lowell.
Yeah, but again, that would be at the peak. And I don't know if that's good. And that's, you know, with everything in the outline, everything working right, being in the zone, not having to go do anything else, and just sitting through that. And I don't know, you know, if you write 20,000 words a day, you know, you'll get your novel done. And if you're doing 80,000 words, you'll get your novel done in 4 days. Is spending another week on it such a bad idea?
Yeah.
Probably not. Yes, yeah. You know, and that was, and I went from a guy that used to struggle to get 500 words, you know, because I just was a guy that would tell you and not show you, you know. Right. You know, and then finally kind of cracking that and putting myself into there and actually seeing it and being inside of there and then kind of learning how that works. Then it became very easy to sit down there and to spit out all those words. But the thing is that, you know, there is something to the idea of stopping periodically, sitting back there and thinking about what you did. I don't believe you should go back and read everything because that will.
That's death.
Right. Yeah, that, yes, you know, yeah. That gets you into these Byzantine deaths you'll never get back out of. But I do think there is, you know, that's what I'm trying to figure out now is that pacing. And that, you know, if I would do a mere 5,000 words a day, I would feel guilty. But now I'm trying to go, you know, that's really not a bad rate.
Yeah. You can crank. Well, and that explains the quantity and
yes.
of works that you've put out there. How do you evolve the character work, because your characters are very rich. They speak authentically. Each of them do. Do you do a big character backstory development, or how does that process evolve for you?
Yeah, the thing that I've realized, my biggest hang up and the problem when I would stop writing, I'd come to that point where and it was, you know, ever get like feel like taking a nap in the afternoon and you feel like you're lazy and you're like, ah, gosh, I guess I'm lazy. And then you realize it's because you didn't eat breakfast or something.
Okay.
And that's the kind of thing that as an adult, I'm still realizing that. I'm like, ah, well, I'm like, oh, no, I didn't eat. That's why. That idiot. It's this basic thing. You're a machine. And when it came to stories, I would encounter these things where I would get to a point where I didn't know what to do next and I didn't realize that. And it's a problem we all have as creative people. We sometimes give up on things and we come up with other reasons because we're creative and we don't realize it's because it's not as thought through as we may have believed it to be. And so I made it a very, very important point that I do extensive outlining when I sit down to do stuff, and I'll go through my outline multiple times, and I really try to understand the character, and I really like to understand each and every character, and I don't give them necessarily full, rich backgrounds, you know, but I try to figure out who's going to be interesting in this story, and, you know, using, you know, Star Wars as my classic literary example.
Okay.
You know, who's, you know, having Luke Skywalker, a guy that, you know, kid that grew up on the farm, he's a great point of view to throw out into the middle of this galactic conflict. And, you know, you say, okay, if you just told it from the point of view of Han Solo, who's a cynical guy who's seen everything and done everything, it could be an interesting story, but the journey is more interesting for the Luke Skywalker character, and the Han Solo is the kind of person he meets along the way. And I kind of use that logic when I sit down and I say, okay, who's going to be interesting and where are they at their life, you know, where they are with this. And with the Grendel's shadow, I liked the idea of this hunter type character who's seen everything, who's a bit cynical about stuff and is kind of wounded in some way you don't quite understand, and you know how he's going to handle this classic sort of monster story. And then the point of view of the kind of the Watts and the guy for him to talk to and do expository stuff is the guy that's lived this sort of very cushy kind of life, and all of this is very new for him, so I could get the fun points out of the adventure, and then I could kind of have this more mature perspective. And that story was designed by the people I was going to put into it. You know, okay. Different characters that would have happened differently.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
That just, you know, it just talking about having the story told from Han Solo's standpoint, that never dawned on me, and it occurs to me that it would be a very different story. It would be a caper story. It would be
well, yeah.
a redemption story rather than a hero's journey, or a very different hero's journey. That's fascinating.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when I sat down to do Public Enemy Zero, I have and just the quick background on that story, it's this young guy who's does this late night radio show, one day finds out everybody basically tries to kill them. They just turn into like this sort of zombie like reaction and want to literally rip him to shreds. And I wanted to do a kind of a take upon a zombie story where they explore the morality of it, where the people are normal afterwards. So it's not like he can just shotgun them in the head and
they
feel like,
cured.
Hey, they're already dead.
Yeah,
because I said, right. That would be interesting to me. And so that part of the story was, if I had a Navy SEAL in the middle of this story, you know, that might satisfy some sort of wish fulfillment thing that happens in a lot of male-centric writing, but it wouldn't be as interesting to me as some 23-year-old kid who is not a violent person, who has a guilty conscience, and to even defend himself would feel bad about it, and he has to get very clever and figure out, you know, how he's going to protect himself. And that's what made the story, at least for me, was the fact that it was him and not somebody else there doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Selection of protagonist is defines everything about the story. Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Right. Yeah.
And gentlemen, I hate to bring this to a close, but the timer has ticked down and is staring at me balefully saying, dude, you did it again. But Andrew, my God, this is fascinating. You have come so recently into this craft and have discovered so much just through sheer determination and awareness and exploration of the craft. It's fascinating.
And 20,000 words a day.
And 20,000 words a day, which is lowly and awesome.
Yeah, well, you know, you take a guy like Isaac Asimov. He would have been doing this interview while you'd hear the typewriter in the back.
Right, right.
Good point. Good.
And saying far more intelligent things.
No, I think
this was a pretty excellent, yeah.
Yeah, we got some gold in here. There's some definite gold. Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing these wonders with us. It means a lot to us. It means a lot to our listeners, and we really, really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Hey, thank you for listening.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Brian, closing thoughts as we wind down to the end of the episode?
You know, I think that whole concept of choice of protagonist, I'd never really examined that closely.
Yeah.
And that's kind of blown my mind, and I know I'm going to be dwelling on that for a while. So, excellent point, and I think this is ranking up there with one of our, you know, more excellent episodes.
I quite agree.
Yeah, so thank you very much, Andrew, for coming on. Yeah. It's great.
And dear friends, thank you for hitting the play button and tuning in, whether you catch it just as it drops or just discovered us 10 years into the future and we're still echoing about the podosphere. Thank you so much. You really closed the circuit for us and give us a reason for continuing on. Thank you for your comments. We're so grateful for that. iTunes, of course, great place to leave some of those. You can also swing out to the website and leave a comment on the episode post itself at www.roundtablepodcast.com. Drop us a line at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Guys, stay tuned. In a couple of days, we're going to have Andrew back, and we're going to do some serious-ass story workshop and Brian, I can't wait.
It's going to be epic.
It is going to be epic. So stay tuned. Until then, you guys take care of yourselves. Brian, any suggestions on pastimes they should engage in?
Go right.
And look for awesome stuff because you find what you're looking for. So look for wow. See you in a couple of days. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.